Hi, good morning. I think we're going to begin. I actually want to start with a story. I did my graduate work at Harvard Divinity School, and I studied there for 3 years in a non-denominational program in which we were being trained to be ministers, which the program defined rather broadly, which is why I could find a place for myself there. My colleagues have since become chaplains in the army, in hospitals, many do interfaith work for nonprofit organizations, and some even have their own churches, because although it is technically non-denominational, there is still an overwhelming Protestant majority there. My first day of school, I was seated next to a young evangelical man named Chris. And we began talking and actually ended up spending a couple of hours chatting about our backgrounds, our families, our career goals. And at the end of the conversation, he turned to me and he said, "You know, talking to people like you makes it so hard for me to believe that all Jews are going to hell." And to be honest, I was flattered. I thought, plus one for the Jews, right? I did not take any offense at his statement because I personally don't believe that all Jews are going to hell. So I figured it's his belief versus my belief. Okay, we can agree to disagree. Anyway, we actually became very, very good friends. I actually flew out to California for his wedding. And don't worry, it was not at a church. It was on a golf course. But we really stayed in touch and have been very, very good friends. The fact that he believed that I was potentially going to hell did not seem to affect our friendship. There was, however, one incident that did cause us a bit of trouble. Because one time we were each discussing our personal theologies, something I didn't even know I had until I got to school. And at the end of that conversation, Chris said to me, "Shu, Jesus is in your life. You just haven't recognized him yet." And I knew at that moment this was his way of dealing with this, you know, with his own belief system, again, the belief that I was going to hell, but the reality of our friendship, and him trying to kind of come to terms with that by saying, "Yeah, Jesus is in your life." But it really, really bugged me, and I called him out on it. And I was trying to pinpoint what exactly was so upsetting about his comment. And I realized that not only was he struggling at this point with his own belief, but he was imposing his own belief system, his own religious categories, onto me. So we couldn't agree to disagree here. And his thought process, while perhaps, again, very well-meaning, to him, he was doing me a charity, saying, "Yeah, you don't have to go to hell after all, because even though you can't admit it to yourself just yet, Jesus is in your life." Again, this was all done from a very good place, well-meaning. But I think was disrespectful on a terribly deep level. He apologized, and we, again, were able to move on. In 2009, researchers from the independent Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life phoned more than 3,400 Americans and asked them 32 questions about the Bible, Christianity, other world religions, world leaders, etc., the place of religion in public life. And the New York Times reported that on average, people who took the survey got half the answers incorrect, including questions about their own faith. So while America is a deeply religious country on some level, we are also deeply ignorant when it comes to religion. Now, interestingly, those who scored at the very highest were atheists and agnostics, those who either do not believe in God or religion at all or are unsure either way. But two religious minorities scored pretty well: Jews and Mormons. And the question is why? Why is it that Jews know a lot about Christianity? The majority of questions were about Christianity and Islam. Why is it that we know so much about other religions? I think that because we are a minority, we are forced to encounter religion on a regular basis. in ways that we may not even be aware of. Well, for example, anybody who grows up in New York who walks outside at this time of year notices some things are a little bit different. There's an enormous tree in the middle of Rockefeller Center. There are lights everywhere. My grandfather liked to tell a story about my dad that when he was a little boy, they were in the mall, and he didn't have a TV. And he sees for the first time a big fat red man in a red suit with a long white beard. And my dad says, "There's a man over there in a big red suit, who's that?" And the horrified looks of everyone who turned to look at a small child whose parents had been depriving him of Santa Claus for all these years, my grandparents quickly scurried him out of there. But today, it's virtually impossible not to know that Christmas is coming up. And even if you live in more insular communities and you're not exposed to the lights, I went to the Yeshiva of North Jersey and we took the bus, we had a regular bus driver. And we in fact had school on Christmas and New Year's, but it wasn't our regular bus driver. So any curious kid living in the United States today is going to have to, just by virtue of the fact that we're a minority living in a majority Christian country, that there is some separation of church and state, but even that is not, complete, will have some encounters, will ask questions. We can't take things for granted. The same thing is true if we lived in a Muslim country. We would have, in America, you may have no idea when Ramadan is, but I guarantee if you live in the Middle East, you would know, right? If you live in a majority Hindu country, whatever it is, if you're the minority interacting with the larger majority religion, you're forced to encounter it at least on some level. And I think in this age of globalization, we encounter religions all the time. It's back in the public sphere on so many levels. And religion always causes people to react. Evaluations of religion in general actually range all the way, we know, from enthusiastic praise to bitter condemnation. On the one hand, by many people, religion has been considered the loftiest, most profound expression of the human spirit. It promotes ideas of order and purpose. It gives people meaning in their lives. It has the potential to inspire people to do good, to find a sense of community, of connection, again, meaning making. That's on the one hand. Many of us probably feel that way about religion. But on the other end of the spectrum are those who will term religion a blight on civilization, responsible for superstition and ignorance, hatred, repression, and even genocide. It's the cause of so much evil and oppression in the world, and again, has potential to cause infinite bad. For Marx, religion is the opiate of the masses. Freud called it a universal obsessional neurosis. But I think that when we evaluate religion in general and any particular religion, we have to always be conscious of the fact that a religion can be divided into its achievements and its ideals. What has the religion actually achieved on the ground, done in the world, versus what does it hope or aspire to achieve? What are its ideals? And we know, even within Judaism, that sometimes an achievement and an ideal are in contradiction with each other. And it's important when we talk about religion to remember, we can't judge it just purely based on what it has done or purely based on what it hopes to do, but actually both. And I think in general, one cannot judge a religion as either good or bad because it has within it the potential to be both. Religion shapes the world we live in because it motivates people's behavior. Again, people's behavior. It motivates their interpretation of texts and how they live their lives. And when human beings are involved in religion and are making these types of decisions, it can be interpreted as both good and bad. I think for believers, something that we hold in common. And I'll be honest, everyone always asks me, why did you go to divinity school? What's a divinity school? Why not just get, you're interested in religion? So get a master's in religion at a university. Why divinity school? And the answer I always gave is that I think that for believers, we hold something very special in common, which is this idea that religion and religious communities can be forces for good in this world. And I wanted to start having a conversation on that level. Not, does God exist? Where do religions start from? No, we're here. And in the here and now, what can we as believers in religious communities do to ensure that this world is a better place? And that's, I think, the starting question. So I was there, but I have to be honest with you. I wasn't 100% sure how Judaism on a theological level felt about other faiths. What was our relationship, the ideal relationship between a Jew and a person of another faith? How should we think about them? And I want to really stress right now, I'm not advocating a particular approach. But I do think that on some level we need to begin to have a communal conversation. Our children, I think, receive many, many mixed messages about people of other faiths. We live in a relatively insular modern community where I think ancient texts meet modern values and realities, and we spend a lot of time as a community trying to navigate this complicated world. But I think we haven't spent enough time talking about how we should think about other religions and the impact of our relationship with another faith, the impact that that has on our own self-identity as committed religious Jews. So that's what I want to discuss with you. And I don't want to weigh in on the merits of studying other religions in depth or really even focus on how to behave respectfully towards other people. And certainly it is not my place to weigh in on the halachic aspects of the above. But what I want to talk with you a bit this morning is about how we can think sensitively and respectfully about other faiths. And I actually think we have the tools within our tradition to begin exploring this question and begin having this conversation. So I want to go through with you now a couple of texts that I think respond to what should the Jewish position towards other faiths be. The obvious place, I think, to begin is with the Tanakh itself. What is the biblical perspective on other faiths? So believe it or not, this is a very difficult question to answer. Why? For the most part, the Bible is not terribly concerned with other faiths. The presentation, I think, from the perspective of the Bible is that Israel is the sole recipient or the exclusive recipient of God's revelation. And we know that as Israelites, as Jews, we are forbidden from worshiping other gods and participating in other religions. In fact, it's the second commandment. So if you look now at source number one, I'm not going to go through it too much in depth right now, but if you look at the first pasuk bet, right, Anochei Hashem Elokecha, but if you look in the middle of that pasuk, Lo yelecha Elohim achayrim al panai, you cannot have any other gods before me. Why not? What is so abhorrent about idolatry from the biblical perspective? Is that it's a breach in the covenant with God. God's covenant with the Jews is exclusive. It's one way. You cannot have another deity whom you worship, or you have broken the exclusive covenant between man and God, between Israelite and God, right? Which is why often the metaphor of husband and wife is used, especially in Nevi'im Achronim, right? Because you are breaking almost that sacred bond, that exclusive relationship of trust where each party is going to do for the other. So from the Torah's perspective, again, Bnei Yisrael seem to be the sole recipients of God's revelation. But on the other hand, the reason idolatry is so terrible is because you're breaking the exclusive covenant you have with God. That said, idolatry throughout Tanakh is often mocked as being ridiculous. The most famous story, I believe, is in Malachim, the story of Eliyahu on Har HaKarmel. This is source number two. We'll look at it for the sake of time, I think, in the English. Source number two. And Eliyahu said unto the prophets of Baal, right? He actually engages in a conversation debate with them over whose God is true. So you have these prophets of the deity Baal versus Eliyahu. And Eliyahu says to them, okay, choose you one bullock for yourselves and dress it first, for you are many, and call on the name of your God, but put no fire under it. He says, let's set up the following test case. Each of us are going to prepare a sacrifice for our respective God, And whichever God accepts the sacrifice, we will know that that is the true God. So Eliyahu says, you, Baal, prophets of Baal, you prepare yours first. And they took, this is Chabav 26, they took the bullock which was given to them, and they dressed it and called on the name of Baal from morning until noon, saying, O Baal, answer us! But there was no voice, nor any that answered. And they danced in halting wise about the altar which was made. And it came to pass at noon that Eliyahu mocked them and said, Cry aloud, for he is a god. Either he is musing, or he has gone aside, or he's on a journey. Or peradventure he sleepeth and must be awake. We see Eliyahu mocking them. Their gods are not answering. And now Eliyahu says, maybe your god went on a walk. Try again in a couple minutes. Or maybe he's taking a nap. Right, that's why he's not answering. Again, very mockery tone. And 28, and they cried aloud and cut themselves after their manner with swords and lances till the blood gushed upon them. Right? And they're getting so into their worship, begging their gods to answer, they begin cutting themselves and doing other practices. And it was so when midday was past that they prophesied until the time of the offering of the evening offering, but there was neither voice nor any to answer, nor that any that regarded. And of course, here again, the Nevi'ei Baal are being mocked. There's this notion that idolatry is ridiculous. So it's completely invalid, not worth too much. But it's interesting, this is in the context not of others, but of Israelites themselves worshiping other gods. Again, because the concern from the biblical perspective is really not about other religions. Jews are not permitted to worship idolatry. So what is the biblical perspective on other faiths? We don't really see anything that says idolatry is wrong for Gentiles. The concern, again, is mostly on the Jews themselves. Well, what's our vision for the end of time? From the biblical perspective. So if you look, a very famous pasuk taken from Yeshayahu Nunvav, Bahaviotim El Har Kadshi Visimachtim Bebet Filati Olotehem Bezivchem Leratzon Amiz Bechi Kiveti Beit Fila Yikare Lechol Ha'amim. Even them will I bring to my holy mountain and make them joyful in my house of prayer. Their burnt offerings and their sacrifices shall be acceptable upon mine altar, for my house shall be called a house of prayer for all peoples. A great universal vision, the prophet Isaiah says at the end of time, all nations shall come and worship. There is not the notion of a great mass conversion to Judaism at the end of time, but that each nation will remain its own, but there will be, even for pagans, hope in the unfolding of God's providential plan, that at some point the Beit HaMikdash will be a place where all religions are comfortable worshiping. So again, very different. We don't have, in our notion of eschatology of the end of times, of the days of the Messiah, a mass conversion to Judaism. Everyone will buy into this. It seems to be that at the end of time, there will still be people who practice some forms of other faith. There will be acceptance of a monotheistic one God. The God of Israel will be the universal God of humanity. But we don't, again, see a mass conversion to the laws and practices of Judaism. Is this tolerance? Again, very, very complicated. Not really the concern of the Tanakh. Okay, well, what about in the early rabbinic period? Do we see any sources that would give us a hint as to what, in the rabbinic mind, should be the approach of Judaism towards other faiths? And here, too, we run into a lot of confusion and multiple attitudes, so it's difficult to define what the rabbinic attitudes towards people of other faiths are. If you look at source number 4 in this Tosefta in Sanhedrin, you get the sense that actually we have both two currents running through rabbinic thought. Source 4, Rabbi Eliezer said, all Gentiles do not have a share in the world to come. As it is written, the wicked shall return to Sheol, even all the nations who forget God. Rabbi Yeshua said to him, if the text had said the wicked shall return to Sheol all nations and was quiet, then I would say like you said. But now the verse said those who forget God, behold, there are saints among the nations and they have a share in the world to come. So this is the machloket. On the one hand, Rabbi Eliezer says, no matter who the Gentile is or what they do, they simply do not have a share in salvation. They do not have a place in Olam Haba. Rabbi Yehoshua says not so. Actually, if there is a righteous Gentile, The gates of heaven are open to him. He can, in fact, have a share in the world to come. And in fact, we poskin, if you can say that, about the world to come. Like Rabbi Yehoshua, right? The majority of you seems to hold that if a Gentile is righteous, namely, they keep the Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noach, the seven Noahide laws, they can, in fact, get a place in the world to come. But throughout the Gemara, we actually see these two strains of thought running through. On the one hand, where Gentiles are portrayed in a very negative light, and on the other hand, this openness to the possibility of their being able to have a relationship with God. So again, I just picked two sources for us to look at as kind of examples of these two attitudes. So if you look at source number 5, it says, talking about Tuma and Tahara, it says, "The graves of Gentiles do not defile, for it is written, 'And you, my flock, the flock of my pastures, are men.' Only you, Israel, are designated men, and non-Jews are not designated as men." This statement from the Gemara is often taken out of context to show the Jewish attitude towards Gentiles. Context is a bit complicated talking about Tuma and Tahara, but from this quote it seems to be saying, at least on some level, however we understand that, that Gentiles are not considered to be human beings on the same level as Jews. That's why their graves do not defile. But then if you look at the next source, from Shmot Rabbah, it says, "The Holy One declares no creature unfit, but receives all. The gates of mercy are open at all times, and he who wishes may enter." Again, this notion that God is accessible to everyone. Any human being who wants a relationship with God can have that relationship. So again, we have very contradictory images from our tradition on which to rely and from which to pull. What I would like to do now is think about 4 theological attitudes that have been categorized by people like Professor Alan Brill and others. They actually come from a Christian categorization of religious thinkers who historically have said something about what the relationship between Jews and non-Jews should look like. There are 4 major categories into which thinkers across historical periods from after the Gemara until today can fall. And what I'd like to do is define each of these 4 categories along a, I believe, theological spectrum that spans right to left, as well as, again, an example from different historical periods of Jewish thinkers who could fall into one of these categories. And as we think about these different approaches that have been offered by major Jewish thinkers and authorities throughout history, the question I would like everybody to kind of keep in the back of their minds is, today, for Jews living in the 21st century, what are the benefits and shortcomings of these potential approaches to the relationship that the Jew should have to the Gentile and the way in which we think about that relationship? Okay? Category number 1. Category number 1 is called exclusivism. The argument of exclusivism is that there is one single truth, one path, one true way to access and have relationship with God. So one's own community and encounter with God are the only and exclusive truth. All other claims are 100% false. There is one way to God and one way to salvation, and that way, says the exclusivist, is my way. And that's it. From this perspective, the Gentile, the other, can at best be a bystander, at worst be an antagonist. Either case, they're absolutely wrong. So let's look now at source number 7, the Maharal. The Maharal was a rabbi and in some ways a Renaissance thinker from Prague, lived 1525 to 1609. And he writes as follows, again, source number 7. "Israel and Edom are inverse and opposite. When one is in ascent, then the other is in descent. At the beginning, Israel is connected to the nations like a shell around a fruit. At the end, the fruit is separated from the shell completely, and Israel is separated from them. The separation from idolaters makes a nation complete in itself and sustains the essence of Israel. Idolaters are compared to water and Israel to fire. If the two substances, fire and water, are mixed together, the water puts out the fire. But if the fire remains distant and separate from the water, then the fire consumes and dries out the water until nothing is left. In truth, this is the uniqueness of Israel. From the Maharal's perspective, the Maharal very much liked binaries. He liked saying this and this, black and white. There is no gray. From the perspective of Israel, our survival and strength comes from the fact that only we are correct and that we need to remain separate from falsehood. So he uses Israel and Edom, okay, as these two opposites, Yaakov and Esav. Rashi does this throughout Tanakh. Any descendants of Yaakov versus any descendants of Esav are put up as paradigms of good and evil. And that's it. We are good, they are evil. We need to remain as separate from them as possible. His mashal with the fire and water is very interesting. He compares here Israel to fire. If water is thrown on the fire, what happens? The fire gets put out. But if you keep the water at a bit of a distance from the fire will cause the water to evaporate until the water is gone. That, he says, needs to be our perspective. And again, I think Rashi very much also held this way. It's an exclusivism based on the historical struggle between two forces in the world, the forces of good and evil. I think, again, if you want to put these thinkers in their historical context, which I think we need to do somewhat, is that both for the Maharal, for Rashi, and for others, there was an acute sense of the physical and spiritual dangers to Jewish life living in Christendom. Certainly, they were persecuted and oppressed by Christians, and even spiritually. So the question is, again, that I asked you to think about is, what are the potential benefits and shortcomings of this approach? We don't have time to engage in a discussion now, though afterwards I would love to hear what people are thinking about this. So very briefly, I think on the one hand, from a very positive level, this teaches us about the special relationship between God and the Jews. It certainly creates a strong sense of a dedicated community with a mission and a purpose. But on the flip side, I think, again, there's a certain narrowness to this approach, forces us to be isolationists on some level, which historically has been problematic. But this has been one approach taken by Jewish thinkers throughout history. Approach number two, inclusivism. Inclusivism, again, I said if we're moving on a spectrum, a theological spectrum, right to left, exclusivism, there's one way, and everything else is absolutely false, it thinks in absolute terms. Inclusivism is next. Inclusivism says one religion is best, but weaker forms of truth can be found within other traditions and within other religions. So, again, one is best, but weaker forms are possible, and they're derivations of the truth. I think the best example of this, if you turn right now on the back page of the Rambam, so actually this parak, which is the 11th parak of Hilchot Melachim in the Rambam, my very, very first Mishnah Torah that I had that I needed to get for high school, my dad actually found in a shameless pile here at Yeshiva University. And it was a very, very old edition. But there was something beautiful about sharing a Rambam that belonged to who knows who from years ago. And I really loved this Rambam. But actually, the piece I'm about to read to you was not in there. Because in the older editions of the Rambam, for reasons you will see in a moment, this excerpt was actually edited or cut or censored out. So, if we look inside now, this is an example of inclusivism. Of course, it's going to start off, let me just warn you, sounding like the Rambam is in the camp of the exclusivists, but then there'll be a shift. But you'll see why perhaps this wasn't included in every edition of the Rambam. Source number 8. Even Jesus of Nazareth, who imagined that he was the Messiah, but was put to death by the court, Daniel had prophesied, as it is written, and the children of the violent among your people shall lift themselves up to establish a vision, but they shall stumble. For has there ever been a greater stumbling block than this? All the prophets affirm that the Messiah would redeem Israel, save them, gather their dispersed, and confirm the commandments. But he caused Israel to be destroyed by the sword, their remnant to be dispersed and humiliated. He was instrumental in changing the Torah and causing the world to err and serve another besides God. That sounds terribly exclusivist. There is absolutely nothing, says the Rambam in this paragraph, positive about Jesus. In fact, Jesus accomplished everything the Messiah would not accomplish. He did exactly the opposite. But the human mind has no power to reach the thoughts of the Creator, for his thoughts and ways are unlike ours. All these matters of Jesus of Nazareth and the Ishmaelite, here he's referring to Muhammad, who stood up after him, are only intended to pave the way of the anointed king and to mend the entire world to worship God together. Thus, for them I shall turn a clear tongue to the nations to call all the names of the Lord, etc. Thus the messianic hope, the Torah, and the commandments have become familiar topics of conversation among the inhabitants of the far isles and many peoples, uncircumcised of heart and flesh. Says the Rambam, we can't understand God's ways, but actually both Christianity and Islam were able to accomplish something that Judaism was never terribly good at, and that is spreading monotheism to others. Christianity was able to, within only a couple of centuries, convert the entire Roman Empire into a monotheistic religion. Islam took the Arabian Peninsula in only a couple of years. They were able to spread monotheism, and in order for the Messiah to come, says the Rambam, we need the world to believe that the Messiah is going to come. And in that way, Christianity and Islam have helped us. So again, this is an example of an inclusive view. God's plan is beyond human understanding, but the God of Christianity and Islam are the same gods as the biblical God of Israel. Rabbi Yehuda Levi, we don't have time, also says something similar. But again, to think about what are some of the benefits and shortcomings of this type of approach. Again, I think on the one hand it's positive because it allows you a commitment to your own text and theology, but still acknowledges other faiths and the place that they can have and the role they can play in salvation history. Others will argue, however, that this is a very paternalistic and condescending view. Your only purpose is because you really help us. So again, different ways to think about it. Moving on, I'm sorry, I'm going to rush through these a little for the sake of time because I want to get to something at the end. Category number three, universalism. This one is the least clearly defined and the most, I think, subtle. But it comes next. We're moving from exclusivism, absolute truth, everything else false, inclusivism. One truth is best, but there are scattered fragments of it in other religions. Universalism. Universalism says the truth is one. That some of the universal truths, such as God, the soul, ethics, have been made available by God to all people. That it's a very God-centered approach in which theism transcends all other elements of the religion. So that again, universal truth is available to humanity beyond revelation. Beyond revelation. God is universally available to all humans. So if you look, for example, at Rav Sadia Gaon, this is source number 9, who lived 882 to 942, a leading rabbi and early medieval Jewish philosopher, he used Aristotle and Plato, etc., to come up with a rational Jewish theology. A Jewish theology that made sense according to logic. And he says in the introduction to his book, Book of Beliefs and Opinions, as for ourselves, the community of monotheists, we hold these three sources of knowledge to be genuine. Right? So he's talking about logic, rationale, perception. These are things that are available to all human beings. All human beings are capable of logically coming to the conclusions of truths about God and about ethics. Everybody has that. To them, however, we add a fourth source, the validity of authentic tradition. This type of knowledge corroborates for us the validity of the first three sources of knowledge. So again, his argument is that religion is a universal phenomena. People can rationally attain a universal knowledge of God. And then revelation just serves to corroborate this rational knowledge that every human being is capable of achieving. Again, this one is the least developed, the most nuanced, hasn't really become so popular, interestingly, until today. You know, in terms of its approach, what's excellent about it is that, again, it allows us a commitment to our own theology, and we say that it's divine, it comes down from the divine, but again, problematic about revelation. I kind of want to stop this here to get to our next category. If we have time, we'll come back to it at the end. Category number 4, pluralism. Pluralism says that all major religions have at least some truth, but no religion is inherently superior or better than any other religion. Pluralism sees the impossibility of a universal truth available to all people. Instead, each religion has access to a piece of the truth, and each is able to carve out its own path to God and salvation, and no path is better or worse than any other path. This is the most controversial, I would say, from the perspective of Judaism, but we do have Rabbi Jonathan Sacks writes about it a little bit in his book, The Dignity of Difference. He really argues that religious communities have emerged in the 21st century as key forces in the global age, and that religious communities need to take on economic, social, and political issues, because if we are not part of the solution, we will surely be part of the problem. And he talks about accepting that a God over all of humanity means that God has relationships with all people without creating a moral absolute of our own religion. So if you look in source number 10, he writes, Judaism is a particularist monotheism. It believes in one God, but not in one religion, one culture, one truth. The God of Abraham is the God of all mankind, but the faith of Abraham is not the faith of all mankind. There is a difference between God and religion. God is universal, religions are particular. Skip ahead to the next paragraph. Christians, Jews, Sikhs, Muslims, Hindus, Buddhists, Jains, Zoroastrians, and Baha'i. Because though we do not share a faith, we surely share a fate. Whatever our faith or lack of faith, hunger still hurts, disease still strikes, poverty still disfigures, and hate still kills. Few put it better than the great Christian poet John Donne. Every man's death diminishes me, for I am involved in mankind. Rabbi Sacks argues that his love for Judaism does not negate the love that other people have for their religions. Truth on earth is not and cannot be the whole truth. It is limited, particular, not universal. His argument, reading the story of Migdal Babel, the Tower of Babel, is that God wants religious diversity. That in fact, for religion to exist and thrive, there needs to be a lot of possibilities out there. He writes, in the course of history, God has spoken to mankind in many languages. Through Judaism to Jews, Christianity to Christians, Islam to Muslims. And actually, in a similar kind of statement, David Hartman says also, right, God speaks Arabic on Fridays, Hebrew on Saturdays, and Latin on Sundays. And this approach within the framework of Judaism is considered controversial. Actually, Rabbi Sacks had to retract certain statements that he made because of how the Jewish community reacted to them. But on some level, he seems to be taking a pluralist view. Again, if you take pluralism to its extreme, on some level, you have to argue that religion is a human construct. And that's what's difficult to people about it. Again, in terms of our communal thinking on this, what's difficult about this is certainly, well, why be Jewish? If every path is equally valid without anyone being superior to the next, why be Jewish? If something else is more appealing and it's equally valid, try that out. And Rabbi Sacks, in his works, I think, spends a lot of time trying to convince people, like in the letter, in the scroll, etc., why Judaism is the best for Jews. But that's one challenge. On the other hand, it does allow us to take a kind of open approach to people of other faiths and allows for interreligious dialogue. Again, 4 perspectives. Exclusivism, right? One truth, one correct way, everything else is false. inclusivism, which says there is one thing that is the best, but some truth in weaker forms can be found in other religions. Universalism says actually God made religion accessible, the basics of religion, the foundations universally available to everyone. And pluralism, which says nobody is the whole truth. We all have different paths to God, and they're all equally valid. We have in our history a variety of theological approaches to other religions. And I think we have the language to be able to have a communal discussion about our theology of other religions. And I just hope that we as a community, when we think about how we educate our children, can bring these texts into a discussion to think positively about what reaction should we have in the 21st century as a community. But I'd like to end actually with one other thought. And that is that sometimes, for the majority of us, our interaction with non-Jews doesn't happen on a communal level. It happens on an individual level. And I just want to talk about for a moment how we can kind of draw a distinction between this communal approach, which again, from a theological perspective, we have a lot of tools and language to talk about it, and an individual perspective. I think for many of us, we interact with non-Jews in business, in politics, in our social circles. And I think in today's day and age, we expect tolerance. We expect respect. We expect that everybody will be understanding when we have to leave at 1 p.m. on Fridays during the whole winter. We expect understanding and tolerance. Right? When we take off the month of September pretty much every year, because holidays seem to fall in the middle of the week every year, right? We expect that at a corporate event, kosher food will be served. These are expectations of being a Jew living in New York in the 21st century. They are. They're expectations that we have. There'll be understanding, there'll be respect, there'll be tolerance. And the question is, given that there are a lot of interaction, in order to relate to people and have people relate to us, how can we train ourselves to think the way we hope other people will relate to us? Do we do that enough? I think tolerance and respect comes from a position of assuming you don't know a lot about the other, which according to some Jewish sources, we shouldn't know. But actually having that attitude in a practical way. I'll give you an example. I've heard from some Jewish thinkers who say, you know, I don't get what the Muslims, Jerusalem's not that important to them. Why are they making such a big deal about it? Jerusalem's barely mentioned in the Quran, if at all. I don't know, is that true? Can I judge what's important to somebody of another faith? Would I feel comfortable if somebody of another faith said, that's not so important to Jews? Do I know? I think that's very complicated. We need to take a step back. I should not impose my religious categories on another because Jesus is not in my life, right? He's not. So how can I think respectfully about the others? In the study of religion, we have this dynamic called the insider-outsider dynamic, okay? Outside, the outsider view is the view from the outside, right? The perspective of the theoretically dispassionate observer whose observation does not influence the practices or beliefs of the observed. And on the other hand, the insider. And that's the view of the practitioners, those who are within the community. I think that both of these groups, being insiders and outsiders, have boundaries that we can't cross. We will never be insiders in another faith. We will always be outsiders. And just as people who are outside our faith will never be insiders. And there has to be respect for that position. So just illustrate what I mean, I'll give you two cute examples. After Senator Joe Lieberman was nominated to be vice president, there was an article in the paper that said the following. The Saturday after he was nominated for the seat of the vice president, Senator Joe Lieberman walked into his synagogue where the entire congregation rose and recited the Ten Commandments, the most important part of their Bible. That is beautiful. Unfortunately, it was untrue because it was Parshat Ve'etchanan with the second retelling of the Ten Commandments. We traditionally, when we read the Ten Commandments, stand up. Now, from the perspective of an outsider, it's a beautiful story. Look at the respect that Jews showed the newly nominated vice presidential candidate. They all rose. It's simply not true. And anyone from the inside knows, Jews will not change their liturgy no matter who walks into synagogue. Right? We're not, if that's what we're reading, that is what we are reading. And we as insiders know that. But I think that even, I gave the following other example, which is fictitious. I'll tell you this now, but I was able to convince a lot of my students of this being the truth. I said, imagine you're a religious anthropologist, and you walk into synagogue on a boy's bar mitzvah day, and you're observing the crowd, and you notice that as he's reading from the prophets, from a book, from a Bible, at the front of the synagogue, somebody is handing out bags of candy to all the women. When the young man completes saying the blessings from his Bible and his prayer book, the women stand up and begin pelting him with candies. The young man takes the Bible in front of him and holds it as a guard. Now, I'm a religious anthropologist. I know a little something about Judaism. Here's my interpretation in the article I'm writing up. This boy, as he reaches the age on which he takes upon himself the yoke of the commandments in heaven, is pelted with candies. Why? Candies were the temptation of his youth. And who throws them at him? Women. The tempters of his future. And what does he do to protect himself against these temptations? He holds up a Bible to show this will guard him against all of the temptations of life. It's a beautiful interpretation. And it works with so many things that we have. It's simply absolutely incorrect. A good theory. Totally wrong. Right? We have an idea that Torah should be sweet and we throw candy as part of the celebration. And unfortunately, at some point, we started putting hard candies into those bags. And because hard candies hurt when they are thrown from a distance and it is our natural gut reaction to defend ourselves from being hurt, people pick up whatever in front of them and block. But again, it's an example of where if I was an outsider reading this, I think, that sounds from the Jews I know, that sounds exactly correct. But it's wrong. Why? Because just because a theory is good and it makes sense doesn't make it true. In both the stories I told you, you're missing the voice of an insider. Did anybody ask a participant in the candy throwing ritual? Did anyone ask a member of Senator Joe Lieberman's shul why everybody was standing up? No, the insider voice is silent. And so instead, what we are doing, and it's subconscious, is we're taking our own understandings, our own categories, and imposing them on the other. So just to conclude with this, an approach I've taken in my own life that I have found helpful, because it allows you to preserve your own faith and commitment without judging others, is called, in the academic study of religion, the phenomenological perspective. In general, just to set it in contrast to two other perspectives. It used to be for most of history that religion was studied by practitioners. People studied their own texts. There was occasional dialogue, but it was studied from the perspective of insiders. And the notion was, God exists. Religion is a reaction to the reality of the divine. That was the argument. And so, for example, if we just take a very kind of crude example, when a believer prayed, God was listening. That theory of religion changed in the Enlightenment and post, and with the publication of Darwin's Origin of the Species. I'm not going to get into the reasons why now, but it became popular now to advocate what was called the reductionist perspective. The reductionist perspective says, what is our interest in the study of religion? Where it came from, its effects on society. It saw religion as a psychological or sociological phenomena that could be studied like any other cultural, psychological, or sociological phenomena. Why do people believe what's psychologically wrong with their brains that causes them to do this? How in society does a religion emerge? So thinkers, you've heard of, again, Marx, Freud, they bought into this kind of reductionist approach to religion. Today it's not popular because it's very offensive. What believer wants to talk to somebody who assumes that it's all made up? Because from the reductionist perspective, when a believer prays, nobody's listening. The hope is that just as we've evolved biologically and culturally, we'll evolve religiously. That we started off as pagan, superstitious, we moved towards monotheism, ethical monotheism, eventually we'll get to scientifically informed atheism. That was kind of the belief. The phenomenological perspective is different because it actually argues that when you're talking to people of other faiths, what your concern should be is how is that faith experienced by the believer? It's not when a believer prays God is listening, or when a believer prays nobody is listening. It's what does the believer believe about who is listening when he or she prays. It is real for the believer. It is true for the believer. So that I'm able to bracket off my own judgment. I'm able to suspend judgment and allow for the believer to be fully immersed and enmeshed in his or her belief. It doesn't matter whether it's true or false. It's not my place to impose that judgment. I am just trying to achieve an understanding of what it means for the believer. So again, for me, what this approach as an individual who I have had a lot of interaction and still continue to have with people of other faith, it allows me full commitment to my belief system, but an openness and an appreciation of their religion for them, that religion for that person. So we encounter people of other faiths on many different levels, as a Jewish people, as a modern Orthodox community, and most often as individuals. And I think we know very little about those whose faith has so shaped our history and continues, I think, to play a part in our destiny. But I think we have the potential to live in a world where people can be committed to their own faith, that we don't sacrifice our own beliefs, our own theology, our own practices, but are okay being side by side with people and their practices and their faith. I'll just end with a very quick story and then I'll take questions after. When I was thinking a lot about this year, actually I always think about this issue this time of year, when you have really short days, the clocks have changed and the zman for mincha is very early. And I was taking classes my first year in divinity school, and I realized I finished a class and I wasn't going to have time to make it home to daven mincha. And I was going to have to find a place in school to do it. But people were everywhere. And I was nervous, and I was looking around for a phone booth, but it's the 21st century, so that didn't help me out. So instead, I just decided at that moment, I looked around and I realized I'm in a place of people who not only respect, but appreciate my having my faith, would want me to practice my faith in a real way. And I remember the first time I davened mincha in Andover Library, which I had to do pretty much for the rest of the winter that semester. And it put into perspective for me that as long as we have relationships, as long as we do come into contact, I think the possibility for respect, for appreciation, for a community of believers to work together to make religion and religious communities forces for good on this earth is there. Have a happy Hanukkah. Thank you so much for listening. I think the next year's time, so I'll take questions privately. Thank you.